Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
He'll find Avogadro for a three, high on the right, good. And Toledo out to a 5-0 lead. But up out top, back to Avogadro, and he knocks down another three. Now on the right wing, handed to Williams, drives baseline around. Lillard got to the basket and scored. Here's Alciguer with a three in the left corner. Boy, doesn't West need a pick-me-up. Lillard flies by, Avogadro shoots the three and hits it. Timeout, Bowling Green. Falcons had stretches tonight where they played very well, but longer stretches where they did not. Final score, Toledo 85, Bowling Green 73.
A new record. Clemens has set a major league record for strikeouts in a game. 20.
He's off and running. Here's the throw by Winter, and he is. Fastest of baseball lanes, Ty Cobb, Lou Brock, and Ricky Henderson, and now Tim Raines, his 800th stolen base.
High drive to left field. Bagwell watches it go, and this is number two of the game for him. Further out toward left center over the 379 side for number 20 and number 400 in his career.
And Bonds hits one high. It's a deep.
The story with Schilling, the ruptured sheath around the peroneal tendon, his right ankle, Marcane itself that they're shooting into that ankle, are blood from the shots. But like a scene from The Natural, a feeble swing by Sierra. He strikes out for the third time, and game six goes to the eighth.
To third, backhanded by the shortstop, Blum, gotta hurry, got him! Yes! 479! Trevor Hoffman has become the all-time saves leader in Major League Baseball history.
There it goes, deep left field, way back, back off.
Manny Ramirez, a three-run home run, and he has the record.
Manny Ramirez, a new Cleveland Indian RBI record with 100.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are Toledo sports leader. Hope you're having an outstanding day wherever you might be. 10 minutes after 3 o'clock means we've got 1 hour and 50 minutes of outstanding awesomeness coming your way right here on The Ticket. We're going to talk about baseball, Hall of Famers in waiting, and they won't be waiting much longer, those who are going to be elected anyway. 6 o'clock tonight, I believe, is the time they're going to be making the announcement.
So right after our drive time is done tonight here on The Ticket, then you'll get your announcements.
And we will indeed have those announcements. So we're going to spend a little bit of time today predicting and previewing and maybe making the case for or against various Hall of Fame candidates. So we're looking forward to talking to Dennis Mantloff about that at 3:35. And beyond that, you and me and Kush. If you got something you want to say about one of these guys, you just heard a little bit of a montage there. Roger Clemens, Tim Raines, Jeff Bagwell, Barry Bonds, Curt Schilling, Vladimir Guerrero, and Manny Ramirez, all included in that montage. All are some of the more prominent names that are expected to get significant or some support in this vote, which, of course, is now done, and the announcement will be made tonight. First-timers on the list include Bagwell, as well as first-timers, where did my list go here of my first-timers versus my returning individuals?
I got the list right here.
Yeah, but hold on a second here, because I had them set up in a certain way, and now I seem to have misplaced that particular paper. Sorry about that. But at any rate, excuse me, the first-timers who are on this list are some of the biggest names in baseball history, and I think we all understand and can appreciate the significance of that. But the question is does the presence of a first-timer make somebody who is a returner to the ballot who didn't make it in previous years less qualified? And the reason I bring that up is to talk about Trevor Hoffman at the start here. Trevor Hoffman, one of the all-time great relievers and all-time saves leaders, is kind of expected to be, this is either now or maybe never, because but in a very short order, Mariano Rivera, the greatest closer of all time, is going to come up on the list. And if you are going up against Mariano Rivera doing the same thing that he does and not as good as he did it, you are essentially going to be thought of as a non-Hall of Famer. There is a matter of guys who play your position coming onto the ballot more recently and thus, you know, grabbing the attention of the voters and pushing somebody else who maybe, you know, is a Hall of Famer but just hasn't gotten a vote in the last couple of years, pushing them further down, saying, well, if he didn't get in before, he certainly isn't getting in now because this guy's better than he was at the very same position. So, here's my list, by the way. There are 19 players debuting on the Baseball Writers Association of America Hall of Fame ballot this year. Some of them are not going to get a lot of conversation simply because there's not a chance in Snowball's chance in hell that they're going to make the Hall of Fame. So let's focus on some names that we do know have a chance, including Manny Ramirez. Started to talk about him before. Jim had part of his, in the montage there, one of his great moments. Manny Ramirez hit .312 over 19 seasons as an outfielder with the Indians, Red Sox, Dodgers, White Sox, and Rays. .312 batting average, 555 home runs, 1,831 RBIs, 12 All-Star game selections. A no-brainer. 9-time Silver Slugger Award winner. 12 years with at least 100 RBIs. Led his league in on-base percentage and slugging percentage 3 times each. And, oh, by the way, helped the Red Sox win the World Series in 2004 and 2007. And, in fact, was the World Series MVP in 2004. No-brainer, right? Wrong. Twice suspended for steroids. Twice, even after they started testing. Too stupid to stop using them after they started testing for them, for crying out loud. All of those numbers that I just mentioned wiped out. At least if I had a ballot. But that's the nature of talk radio. You can disagree if you so choose at 866-240-1065. Can you wipe out all those numbers without knowing how many of them were impacted by the juice? Would the 555 home runs be 455 home runs without it? Would the 1,800 RBIs be, 1,400 RBIs? Would 12 All-Star Game selections fall to 9? And on down the line you go. You just don't know. And that's why, for me, if you cheated, ever, you're done. Because it taints every single wonderful number that we can share about you. Same exact story. Well, not exact story, but similar story for a Detroit Tigers favorite, fan favorite, also a fan favorite of the Rangers and Marlins and Yankees and Astros and Nationals. And, of course, I'm talking about Pudge Rodriguez. He appeared in more games as a catcher over 21 seasons than any player in big league history, 2,427 games caught. 14 times he was an All-Star. 13 Gold Glove Awards. No-brainer. 1999 AL MVP. .296 for his career batting average. 2,844 hits, 311 home runs, 1,332 RBIs. 2003 NLCS MVP en route to leading the Marlins to the World Championship. No-brainer, right? Wrong. Same issue. PED connections change every single number that you hear, maybe with the exception of the number of games caught.
And Pudge's, to me, in a way, is almost worse than Manny Ramirez, because without it, the real discussion on Ivan Rodriguez would be, is he the greatest catcher ever?
That's right. That's very true. You know, and if you really look at some of the greatest catchers of all time, and the first name that jumps to the top of my mind is always Johnny Bench. Although you can make arguments for Mike Piazza, of course, who's the greatest power-hitting catcher ever. And go back, through some of the great names in baseball history. You're right, Pudge Rodriguez's name would be in that top 3 or 4 or 5 in the conversation. But it can't be. It can't be because of the PED connections. Vladimir Guerrero, 318 was his career batting average over 16 years in the big leagues. It's a long time. Expos, Angels, Rangers, Orioles. 449 home runs, 2,590 hits, 1,496 RBIs. He had 10 years with at least 100 RBIs, stole 181 bases he could run, and was the 2004 AL MVP. Won 8 Silver Sluggers, known for his powerful throwing arm in right field as well. He led the National League, he led his league in intentional walks 5 times and finished with 250 for his career, good for 5th place all time. And that's a strong stat right there. Vladimir Guerrero, is he a Hall of Famer? Time will only tell. 6 o'clock is specifically the time. Those are the biggest names on the Welcome to the Party list. These are the newbies on the Hall of Fame ballot for 2017. Some of the returners, including some of the highest vote totals received, and those are the ones I want to share first. Let's throw two. These are 15 former players returning after receiving at least 5% of the vote overall in 2016. With 71.6% of the vote, just a hair under the 75% requirement, in his 7th year of eligibility, Jeff Bagwell. Jeff Bagwell's numbers are amazing, but Jeff Bagwell's PED connections are equally amazing. We'll get into him. Tim Raines. You heard a little bit of his highlights there as well in the montage put together by Jim Cushlin. Tim Raines got 69.8% of the vote last year. This is his 10th and final year of eligibility. If Tim Raines does not get in, there's going to be trouble, at least as far as I'm concerned. One of the greatest offensive weapons of his era, the greatest leadoff man maybe of any era, not named Ricky Henderson. Unfortunately, Tim Raines happened to have his career be at the exact same time as Ricky Henderson. But Tim Raines, and he's about 6% away from getting to that magic number now, Tim Raines did things on the base paths and did things to get on the base paths that really nobody ever has. I was always a huge fan of Tim Raines when he was with the Expos as I was growing up in the 80s. He was just so good. The fact that he is not in yet, it's to me an affront to all things good about the game. Not only was he a great player, he's a great person. And I'm going to throw one stat. I've got a lot of stats that I can throw at you for all of these guys, and I will. But just let me throw this one at you for Tim Raines. Tim Raines, and I heard this stat earlier this morning, reached base 4,000 more times than the great Tony Gwynn, who virtually walked right into the Hall of Fame. Tim Raines got on base 4,000 times more than Tony Gwynn, who was one of the great on-base guys. One of the great, you know, we know what a magician he was with the bat, being able to just slap balls from here, there, finding holes everywhere. It's what made him one of the great control base hitters of all time. Tim Raines reached base 4,000 times more than he did. That should tell you something about him. Trevor Hoffman. We'll get into him, I told you, one of the all-time great relievers. Curt Schilling had 52% last year. He's in his 5th year of eligibility. To me, this is also a no-brainer. He absolutely needs to be in, and he's being held back because of his political beliefs. Yes, you heard me, and yes, we will go there. Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, 45 and 44%. Very happy that in their 5th year of eligibility, they're still not getting anywhere near the 75% support they need, but disappointed in the fact that over the 5 years that they have been eligible, their numbers go up a little bit each time, making it appear as though there's going to be a breaking point where older writers who are holding the PED allegations against them, and newer, younger voters are coming in and saying, nah, the heck with that. We want the one of the winningest all-time pitchers and the all-time home run leader and so on and so forth in the Hall. Big problem there. We'll get into that. Edgar Martinez, 43% in his 8th year. Question, of course, do DHs make the Hall? Should they if they're only part-time players? Mike Mussina, one of the great contemporaries of the likes of Clemens and Schilling, did tremendous things with the Orioles and Yankees. He got 43% in his 4th year of eligibility now. He's back. Lee Smith in his 15th and final year of eligibility. Only 34% last year. Again, another great save total leader. But
he was the all-time saves leader when he retired.
But is he one of the greatest relievers of all time?
Right.
You know, and I know it sounds very, it could be very contradictory. How do you lead the, you know, all-time, how do you have the all-time saves lead and not be considered one of the great relievers? Well, there is collecting and racking up saves, and then there is being a dominant closer. You know, a complete stopper, a door slammer, et cetera. And that isn't necessarily the case with Lee Smith. And we'll talk about that. Fred McGriff, 20%. The crime dog is back in his eighth year. Jeff Kent got 14%. He's in his fourth year, one of the best offensive second basemen of his era and maybe of all time. But one of the all-time petulant punks that nobody likes, by the way. Larry Walker, 15.5%. In his seventh year, Gary Sheffield, 11%, Billy Wagner, 10%, and Sammy Sosa. Same story we talked about with Clemens and Bonds and many others, 7% in his fifth year. He's not getting anywhere close. Now, the irony of all of that, and Cush, feel free to jump in here as I kind of just ran through some of those guys. The irony of the Sosa thing is this. If you decide you're going to let Barry Bonds and or Roger Clemens into the Hall, you simply must open the door for the rest of the all-time numbers producers among the PED crowd. For example, Sammy Sosa, in an 11-year stretch, averaged 48 home runs a year. He is the only man in history to go over 60 home runs four times. And while we would say, look at all those things under normal circumstances and say, oh, my God, he is a hitting god. We all know that all of that was aided by steroids when he and Mark McGwire decided to engage in the I can hit more than you can run of 1998 and beyond. But here's the thing. Bonds has crept up now in his fifth year of eligibility to 44% of the vote. Sosa, in his same exact fifth year of eligibility, has 7% of the vote. How do the writers justify yay on one and nay on the other when they are both the same exact shining example of performance-enhancing drug cheats? Cush?
That's always been an interesting question to me. I mean, I think part of it is because everyone, probably ourselves included, would acknowledge that even more so than Sosa, Bonds, Clemens, PED stuff out of the way, yeah, they'd have been first ballot type guys, where Sammy Sosa, despite 609 home runs, regardless of how many are PED aided or not, it feels like less of a case.
I hear that argument all the time. I hear that argument all the time about, you know, what they did in first ballot Hall of Famers without, you know, before they started using. But they started using.
Right.
And that changes the entire discussion. That argument to me holds about as much water as, I don't know, let's say I'm 30 years old and I rob a bank and then I decide I got a taste for it and I rob another one. And for about a three-year stretch of my life from 30 to 33, I rob a bunch of banks or businesses or whatever, right? And I go before the judge and the judge is about to sentence me to a long time in prison because for a three-year stretch of my life I robbed banks. Does she want to hear, or he, that judge, that, no, but before I started robbing banks, I had an impeccable record of 30 years of no crimes. I didn't do anything wrong for 30 whole years. Doesn't that outweigh the 3 years that I did bad stuff, Your Honor? You think I'm still going to prison? You're damn right I'm going to prison. Well, guess what? I don't want to hear that for, you know, 15 or 10 or 12 or whatever years of your career, Roger and Barry. I don't want to hear that, hey, you didn't break any rules or about cheating during that period of time, but you did for a 3, 4, or 5 year period, because your record is a total one. It is not, it cannot be segmented or partitioned off where, hey, I was super good, therefore the super good time that I was innocent and I was not breaking laws or rules or whatever, cheating or whatever you want to call it, it should wipe out the other time when I did. Your record is your record from start to finish. And that's the bottom line. If you are going to put somebody in the all-time Hall of Fame, then they go in there with everything they accomplished. You can't just say, Roger Clemens had a Hall of Fame career before he first started juicing, and then cut off the numbers there. Or if you do, you damn well better cut off the numbers there on the plaque and on any records and everything else. And you know they can't do that, and they won't do that. Does Barry Bonds catch and pass Hank Aaron without the juice? Hell no, he doesn't. His career high prior to juicing was 49. Suddenly, he starts jamming needles into his arm and his butt and everywhere else, and suddenly he hits 73. You know, same thing with Sosa, same thing with McGuire, same thing with Clemens. I mean, these guys, I don't care how good they were before or how good they were, you know, after. The point is, during that period of time, they have completely sullied themselves and all of their records, and every number has now an asterisk next to it. Every single number is tainted. No matter what anybody says, you're going to look at them and you're going to say, what were his real numbers? Was he really one of the greatest all-time players? And if you say, yeah, before he started juicing again, then I say, I was one of the greatest all-time people before I started robbing banks. I'm still going to be in prison. Go ahead, Jim.
No, again, I'm not saying that's a good reason. I'm just saying that that seems and feels to be part of the reason if you're looking for why there's such a discrepancy between Clemens, Bonds, and, say, Sosa in terms of the percent totals. Other than that, I'm not really sure, and quite frankly, never have been really sure what to attribute it to. I just haven't.
Yeah. It is very interesting to see. It's going to be very interesting to see how much the younger voters, as they start, as they start pushing some of the older writers and voters out, and not that they get pushed out, but they retire and whatnot, how much less serious they see these violations than those who were covering the game during that era, during the 1990s and during the early 2000s. And really, quite frankly, we're not done. I mean, crying out loud, Abel Monte just got suspended from the Indians this past season for PEDs, right? You know, it's much less rampant now, but it's still there. And it'll be very interesting to see how serious the more modern writers going forward really take this whole thing. All right, we're going to get a timeout here because I want to get Dennis Mandeloff on the air, and I want to hear from you as well. And if you're on hold... Oh, boy, I feel bad because I don't want to make people wait for the interview because then you're not going to get on the air until after 4 o'clock. All right, let me squeeze a couple in quickly. Let me squeeze a couple of calls in. Then we got to make room for Mandeloff. I don't have a ton of time, Greg and Milbury, but I do have you on the air. I'll let you make your point. Go ahead, Greg.
Hey, this is going to be quick, man.
You got it, buddy.
I think that since all the fans are spending the money to pay for these, like, to go watch these guys, I think we should have a people's choice and put Pete Rose in. That's all I say, and you guys have a good day.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it. Thanks for making a brief, too. And absolutely, Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. Different, far, 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 far different than PEDs. Is gambling a cardinal sin? Yes, it is. Does it mean he didn't get 4,256 hits, wasn't it? I think is the all-time total. And as the all-time hit king, no, it doesn't. He did those all on his own. He did not cheat to do them. He did not put needles in his arm or spike his drinks or anything else. Pete Rose's accomplishments as a player are unparalleled. Put him in, absolutely. And if you want to put a little note there saying banned from baseball permanently for gambling as a manager, then fine, do it. But you put the player in the Hall of Fame. Thank you. Dean in Toledo, I've got a minute for you. Dean, go ahead, buddy.
How's it going, Bob? Hey, I just say it though. McGuire, Sosa, and Bonds saved baseball. Now, I'm far from being a PED expert, but and still, as a hitter, you still need that eye contact. You still need that bat speed. I don't see where PEDs actually reflect a hitter compared to a pitcher. That's all I got, Bob. I know you guys
got
short.
Thanks, time. Brother. I appreciate your point on that. And I would say the same thing. You're right. I mean, you don't become a better hitter with better hand-eye coordination and a better able to hit a ball, that sort of thing, simply because you are stronger and you have more and you're using PEDs. But this is the issue. Hank Aaron didn't use PEDs, and Hank Aaron got pushed down from the top spot to the second spot. You had all-time home run hitters pushed out of the top 10 in the baseball record books. And what is baseball if numbers? Baseball is nothing but numbers. Baseball is all about its history and its numbers. Statistics mean more in baseball than they do in any other sport.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, it's amongst the four, it's the most important one.
That's right, and that's how careers are judged, is by their statistical finishes. And when guys who did not cheat have their numbers pushed down and devalued by guys who did cheat, that to me deserves, you know, the ultimate punishment, and that is banishment from the Hall of Fame. And that is what guys like Bonds and Sosa and McGuire and others deserve. They pushed clean players out of their positions in baseball's all-time record books, and that, to me, is unforgivable. More of this coming up. Your calls and Maniloff next on The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward we roll right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Thanks for being with us for the extravaganza on this Wednesday afternoon, talking Hall of Fame in baseball as the writers' votes are all tabulated and totaled up, and the announcement is made tonight at about 6 o'clock right after we finish Drive Time, which follows this program right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Joining us now to analyze the would-be, could-be, maybe, should-be finalists who are going to be inducted this summer is Dennis Maniloff, sports writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com, and author of From A to Z, Andrews to Zastadil, a collection of Plain Dealer sports writer Dennis Maniloff. Your subtitle's so damn long, Dennis, it's hard to remember. Favorite interviews. How you doing, brother?
What's up, Bob France? How you doing, man?
I'm good,
exciting
man. Good
day.
To talk
exciting
to you, as
day
always.
In sports.
I'm sorry, say again?
Very exciting day in sports.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, what's most exciting for you? Are we just about the Hall of Fame itself?
Yeah, I mean, okay. Hall of Fame Day is incredible. I can't even imagine what these guys are going through. You know, what kind of butterflies are going through people like Rock Reigns, who I believe will get in. But even the guys that are, you know, right on the border, the Hoffmans, the Vlad Guerreros, it's just incredible the amount of nerves that must be going right now.
Yeah, especially for somebody like Reigns, who is, you know, in his last year of eligibility. If he doesn't get in now, he's going to have to wait until some veterans committee or something else a few years down the road decide to change their mind on him and put him in. And let's start with him, Dennis Maniloff, because Rock Reigns, to me, was one of my favorite players growing up in the early 1980s especially. He put together some years that I never, ever would have seen, you know, thought somebody could do as a leadoff hitter if he wasn't doing it at the same exact time as the GOAT in that category, Ricky Henderson. And Rock Reigns, to me, is long, long overdue as far as being put into the Hall of Fame. His statistics are off the charts, over 800 stolen bases. And this is something I heard Dennis Maniloff earlier today that I did not know, that blew my mind. Everybody's Hall of Famer, Tony Gwynn, one of the great guys in terms of on-base percentage. He was a magician with the bat. He could just find every hole in any hole whenever he had to, change his swing, etc. Do you know, and I'm sure you do, Tim Raines, in his career, reached base 4,000 more times than the great Tony Gwynn. If that's not a Hall of Famer, for goodness sakes, I don't know what is. What are your thoughts?
Well, I've had Reigns on my ballot. I've named him on my ballot since I had it. I'm almost positive. If I missed the first year, then maybe I did. But the rest of them, I've always put Reigns on. I believe he's a Hall of Famer. I look at him the way I do Burt Blyth. And by the way, let's be clear here. He's going to get in. All right. I'm looking at the projections. Ryan Thibodeau on Twitter, the great guy who keeps track of the ballots. And, you know, Reigns is safe. I would be stunned beyond stunned if Reigns doesn't get in. So, but yeah, I mean, you can never be sure, I guess. But here's the thing.
What's weird about him, Dennis, and this is the weird part about voting and about how the Writers Association changes, you know, as older guys retire and kind of get weeded out and younger writers come in, et cetera, et cetera. Tim Raines, and I heard this statistic last night, as far as his years on the ballot, he had 2 years in which he was in the 20th percentile, 20%, you know, of the vote. He had 2 years in the 30s, 2 years in the 40s, and 2 years in the 50s, and last year was up at 69%. How does that happen? Because over you know, the last 14 years since he last played baseball, he didn't add any hits to his total, any stolen bases to his total, yet he goes from 20s to 30s to 40s to suddenly now somebody in a different, you know, a different crowd of writers, I guess, is looking back and saying that guy should be in, at least more than not.
Well, you know, I hear that a lot. Like, how can guys gain ground when they haven't done anything? And it's simple. It's research. It's, you know, with Burt Blyleven is an example I use. I always believed that Blyleven was a Hall of Famer. A lot of my colleagues didn't. But Blyleven eventually got in. One of the reasons, because people actually did the research and they looked at comparable numbers and how Blyleven stacked up against Hall of Famers, and he did just fine. So you can, over time, continue to do research, and I think in the case of Reigns, you have to give the credit to the sabermetrics guys. You have to give the credit to the 21st century baseball numbers crunchers, because What they have done is drawn the direct comparison to Tony Gwynn. They have drawn the comparisons to Ricky Henderson with the so-called new school metrics, and Reigns has graded out incredibly well. That's why I think Jim Thome, as a guy that we talk about here in Cleveland, I think Thome is in great shape to be named on the first ballot as a Hall of Famer, because sabermetrics love Jim Thome. Jim Thome's a 400 career on base guy, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, he's going to be in a favorable light, just as Reigns was with the sabermetrics people, with the new school metrics. And I think that's where Reigns owes a huge debt of gratitude.
Dennis Maniloff joining us. Dennis is with the Baseball Writers Association of America. We're talking about the Hall of Fame balloting, which, of course, is completed now. The announcement will be made tonight at about 6 o'clock. Dennis, let's get the elephant out of the room, and that is, of course, the PED guys. We know that we have been watching for the last 5 years the vote totals steadily climb for guys like Bonds and Roger Clemens. Not so much, interestingly enough, for Sammy Sosa. So it's interesting how the writers can say yay to some steroid cheats and nay to others, at least, you know, on the climb and the percentages. But now we have new names on that list this year. First time eligibility for the likes of Manny Ramirez. First time for Ivan Rodriguez. First time seventh time for Jeff Bagwell, but perhaps his closest to getting there since he was at 71% last time around. But you got some names here, very interesting ones, that are joining the Bonds and Clemens PED club, if you will, and making it very, very expansive. Guys who have put together some of the greatest numbers in the history of the game, all in one giant group. The question I have for you as a writer, Dennis, and a voter, are they all one group? And if one of them goes in, you green light all of the PED era guys who are worthy by their numbers? Or is it, no, on a case-by-case basis, I can make an exception for this guy or that guy?
Absolutely a case-by-case basis. Now, Bob, as far as I know, the Baseball Writers Association of America frowns upon us making our ballots public before the announcement. Even though Ryan Thibodeau collects a lot of the ballots and people have made it public, I was going to say,
Verducci already wrote a column announcing it and defending it.
Right, a lot of us have. And I'm going to do a video right after the announcement, and my ballot will, you know, officially be made public for whatever that's worth.
Gotcha.
But I can say, you know, a couple of guys I voted for and a couple of guys I didn't. I obviously, as I said, voted for Reigns. I will tell you straight up, I voted for Pudge Rodriguez, and I voted for Jeff Bagwell. I did not vote for Bonds. I did not vote for Clemens. I did not vote for Sosa. I did not vote for McGuire when he was on the ballot. Here's the bottom line. I look at it in a case-by-case basis. My threshold is preponderance of evidence. Okay. Does a preponderance of evidence exist, the civil court threshold, to say that someone has used PEDs and cheated the game, brought shame to the game, and, you know, you can even invoke the character clause if you like as an envelope to that. In my mind, there is a preponderance of evidence that Bonds and Clemens, even though they never failed a test, used PEDs. Therefore, they are not getting my vote. I find it curious that these guys are gaining votes, because unlike what I said about Reigns, it's not a matter of research, extra research with Clemens and Bonds. You don't need to do any more research. Their numbers scream off the page Hall of Famer. But why are they gaining? Well, they're gaining because I guess there's more tolerance for guys who I believe have a preponderance of evidence toward cheating. Now, Pudge Rodriguez, you say, well, what about him? What about Bagwell? The reason I talk about case by case is I investigate each one of these guys individually, and in my opinion, there is not a preponderance of evidence, only suspicion, only whispers, that Rodriguez and Bagwell, and for that matter, Piazza. I voted Piazza. Okay, he gets in. For a while, he didn't get in, and everybody said, oh, he did Royce. Well, I had plenty of Piazza guys come to me and say, look it up. Substantiate it. And you know what? I could never do that, and therefore Piazza got my vote. That's how I'm looking at the PED guys.
Tell me why Pudge.
Why
did you vote for Pudge?
Because he was a great player, and I I don't have a preponderance of evidence that he used. Only whispers, only rumors. That's all I could find. Okay? It's unlike.
Doesn't his own almost admission play a role in the preponderance of evidence? Because what he did in that interview with the Associated Press, when he was asked about whether or not his name appears alongside Alex Rodriguez and the other 100-plus players who tested positive in the 03 MLB steroid survey, his response was, only God knows. In other words, he didn't say, of course not. I've never taken anything illegal in my life. He didn't do the Rafael Palmeiro finger wag or anything of that nature. He just said, only God knows. If you don't even deny it definitively, you are essentially admitting it definitively. And I think that's got to carry some weight here. You know,
I think, I'm not saying it didn't with me, and I understand what you're referring to. I saw that as I put together my case for and case against. I mean, well, I did a case for and case against with all the guys I voted for and didn't vote for.
Sure.
But Rodriguez's case for is easy in terms of his numbers and his what you saw with your eyeballs. You know, on the field, there was no denying it. But then you say, okay, a case against, you have these various allegations or these various whispers, and one of which is what you're talking about, what you're referring to. But I don't know. I didn't want to get inside the mind of a guy and know exactly what he was trying to say or what he wasn't trying to say. I have my suspicions about Rodriguez, just like I have my suspicions about Bagwell, just like I have my suspicions about Piazza. But again, I couldn't, in my research, say definitively that there was so much evidence there that it was impossible to ignore. For example, Barry Bonds. I mean, I know Barry Bonds is a bigger name than Pudge Rodriguez, granted.
Sure, sure.
But Barry Bonds had two books written about his alleged use of PEDs. All right, 700 pages worth of documentation regarding his alleged use. That's what I'm talking about. That kind of, and I realize, would people want to read two books worth of Pudge Rodriguez if in fact the stuff existed? Probably not. But the point is, I had plenty to go on, plenty of testimony against Bonds, against Clemens, McNamee, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Versus Rodriguez, I just didn't have enough to definitively say, in my mind, that he used.
I want to read a little bit from Verducci, who made his argument. He posted this early today about noontime. Made his argument why he voted for and against certain individuals. And I want to bring up Bagwell, since you did say, I heard you correctly, right? You voted for Bagwell.
I did.
Okay. I want to read a little bit from Verducci, and I don't know if you saw this or not, but for the fans listening right now who didn't, they should hear this. So
I love Verducci, by the way.
I do, too. And I just want to hear the point-counterpoint for all of this, if you don't mind. Okay. PED suspicions will follow Bagwell into Cooperstown. Here are the facts. He said he hired a bodybuilder in 1995 to make him, quote, as big as I can, end quote, without concern for flexibility. Admitted he took androstenedione, a steroid precursor, underwent a massive body change, a la Bonds, called the whistleblowing on steroids in baseball in 2002 by Ken Caminiti and 2005 by Jose Canseco a shame, said, quote, very disappointing, whether it's true or not, talking about the whistleblowing, promulgated the red herring that drugs don't help baseball players, quote, hand-eye coordination is something you can't get from a bottle, end quote, and as recently as 2010, 7 years ago in an ESPN interview, openly endorsed steroid use by anyone from a fringe player, quote, I have no problem with that, to superstars such as Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire, quote, I know you took it, but it doesn't matter, as well as the HGH use by an injured in Andy Pettit, quote, that's not a performance enhancer. Bagwell once said, I'm almost done here, Dennis, if I ever do get to the Hall of Fame, there are 40 guys sitting behind me thinking he took steroids, then it's not even worth it to me. As a steroid apologist and someone who doesn't want a clean game, he invites such thoughts. I abhor his stance on PEDs, but without public evidence that he took them, I voted for him. So here's Tom Verducci laying out an almost FBI director-like case of guilt against a person, and then at the very end flipping the script and saying, but I voted for him. It sounded like the FBI director James Comey and Hillary Clinton when he laid out the prosecutorial case. This is a guy who essentially is openly endorsing steroids in baseball, which accompanies, and to me is then, therefore, it is kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not existential evidence. you know the word I'm looking for.
Exculpatory?
No, that wasn't it either. It's a more simple word than that, and I feel stupid for not knowing it right now. But at any rate, it is circumstantial is what I was looking for. It's circumstantial evidence that lends credence to the notion that he took steroids, the fact that he openly and verbally endorses steroids in baseball. That, to me, is enough to say, you're not going in, Bags.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, Bagwell, to me, was tougher. It has always been tougher than, for example, Pudge Rodriguez. You know, and I don't remember every single ballot I filled out. I think I've had it for 5 or 6 years, Bob. I wish I had the photographic memory or the great memory, but I want to say one of those years I did not vote for Bagwell. Just like one year I did not vote for Piazza, and under similar sort of suspicions, and I got stuff from Bagwell's, not his camp, but Bagwell supporters who said, hey, look it up and verify that he used. I mean, actually dig and try to find it. I'm not saying I saw everything that Verducci, that you quoted Verducci as chronicling about Bagwell, but I was aware of Bagwell's stance on certain issues surrounding PEDs. And yeah, it was troubling, but I guess my fallback is exactly what Verducci said at the very end. You know, absent of the evidence as opposed to the viewpoint, I just went ahead and did vote for Bagwell, you know, and so yeah, maybe I made a mistake there, but I'm absent of, you don't want to say proof, but absent of actual evidence and actual testimonies against Bagwell, I didn't feel comfortable not voting for him.
I understand, and I think that's fair to me. And then, as I finally figured out the word I was looking for, though, circumstantial evidence is still evidence. We don't live, you know, it's kind of weird, Dennis. I think we are kind of living now in an era where everybody has a smartphone, and therefore every crime almost is caught on video. That if a crime isn't caught on video, well, then it didn't happen. And cases have been proven against people many, many times for many, many decades and centuries without video evidence. And I think we almost look for, we didn't see the needle going into the backside on somebody's hidden camera video, so therefore, you know, we can't convict him on that. And that, to me, is a shame, because there is a lot of evidence against a lot of people. So,
but let me say a couple things, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me just, it's very important to me to say this while I'm on with you. You can go after me about certain guys that I picked or I didn't pick, but two arguments that I find to be nonsensical are, number one, I'm not going to vote for anybody because they're all dirty, okay? That, to me, is a bunch of malarkey. The punishment of clean players, it should never take place just because you had dirty ones among the bunch. And I think about Jim Thome. Not a shred of evidence, not a whisper has ever been credible about Jim Thome. And you're going to say, well, Tomey's numbers aren't as important because he played in the steroid era. I hate when innocent guys are punished. And the other argument that to me is ridiculous is this idea that they were Hall of Famers before the alleged use. And that's been the
Christian,
common.
I talked about that before you came on. Yeah, that's exactly
that right. That is a bunch of garbage. Okay. With all due respect to you, I don't know what your stance was, what Kush's stance was, but respectfully, whoever holds that view is, to me, ridiculous, and I love my colleagues, and I'm sure I'll have to talk to some of them who do, but this idea that you were a Hall of Famer before the alleged cheating, I think I said this to you on the air before, Bob, you're taking an exam. You ace the first 99 questions of the exam. On the 100th question, you look over at your buddy's test, and you cheat right off of his test for the 100th question. And there's a proctor who sees you cheating. What happens to your exam, Bob?
You fail automatically.
Do you get credit? Do you get credit for 99%?
No, you do not.
And an A+? No, you get an F. You fail. So this is such a bunch of garbage with this. Well, Bonds was a Hall of Famer well before he became big, or Clemens was a... come on.
You have used that example with me before, Dennis, and I came up with my own last half hour almost off the cuff. That if between the ages of 30 and 33, I robbed 6 banks and I come before a judge, I don't get to do the, but from ages 0 to 30, I committed zero crimes. I was absolutely a perfect law-abiding citizen. Doesn't that wipe out what I did for those 3 years when I lost my mind and robbed banks? The answer is get your ass to prison. So
right, you could be citizen of the year for 20 years and then rob a bank, and guess what? You're going to jail for robbing a bank. Who cares if you were citizen of the year?
Dennis,
driver's test. Last turn, I run into a stop sign. Am I going to pass the test? No. I'm failing the test.
That's a great example, too. Dennis, a couple more quick ones because we're going to get you out before 4 o'clock or as close to it as possible. Manny Ramirez, former Indian, we know. I think we both agree one of the greatest right-handed hitters we've ever seen. But again, you know, the steroid taint is there. Now, he failed tests after they started testing. You have verifiable evidence, so he's a no-go, right?
Absolutely no for me. And that because, failed tests and other evidence.
Okay.
Yeah, Manny's got a mile-long evidence that he used,
Shifting gears away from steroids now to a different issue. And this is one that I know is a little bit personal for you because you know him personally. And I want to talk about Shill. Curt Schilling, one of the greatest postseason pitchers of all time, one of the greatest clutch performers in the history of the game, with some numbers that are absolutely off the charts, is only getting 50% of the vote prior to this year. And there is a strong belief that he's not going to get near 75% again this year, even if there are voters who believe he should, because they don't like him, because he's on Twitter. And he is a very conservative, outspoken guy who has tweeted and posted some things that others may find controversial. I do not personally, but others might find controversial. And that he's going to be held back not because of PED suspicions like the people you and I talked about, but because of, political opinions that he holds that drive some people crazy that led him to getting fired as an analyst from ESPN. Is Shill going to make it, and how do you respond to those who think that what he says on Twitter somehow overshadows what he did on the field?
Well, number one, Schilling is not going to make it into the Hall of Fame. His only chance would be Veterans Committee down the road. He's not getting the votes this year, and he won't get them in the years to follow.
Did he get yours?
I've known Schilling for, what's that?
Did he get your vote? Can you say that?
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he did. Because I look at him as a baseball player. And granted, I have a little bias because I've known him for a while. But I'm not tight with him. And I certainly don't condone some of his tweets and some of his, viewpoints that go to the extent that they have. The outlandish nature of some of his tweets and some of his language.
I have no problem with him.
Well, okay. I mean, that's where we differ. And, and he says sometimes he jokes about certain things that certainly sound bad when they first come out. And then he says he jokes. Look, just because you know a guy and you get along with a guy, it doesn't mean you have to be in lockstep with him and agree with their political views. So while I don't endorse some of what Schilling says and does on Twitter, social media, whatever, I'm not using that at all in my criteria. Well, when I look at Curt Schilling, is he worthy of the National Baseball Hall of Fame? And in my opinion, even if I didn't know him at all, even if I'd never interviewed him as a player, I look at his numbers. I look at his postseason specifically. I look at the fact that he pitched on terrible teams, which hurt his for many years, certainly with Philly, that hurt his numbers.
His win total.
And among other things. But lack of run support, things like that. I am fine with putting Schilling, down as one of my picks, but I am able to separate the Curt Schilling, the retired, opinionated guy from Curt Schilling, the ball player.
Okay, and that is certainly fair. Last thing before you run, how do you feel about being limited to 10 votes per calendar year or per vote? You get to only pick 10 guys. That's all you get to do. Even if you believe there are 15 guys, for example, who are worthy, you may say yes to Trevor Hoffman, but no to Billy Wagner, even though you think they both deserve spots as tremendous relievers all time, but you're limited to 10, so somebody gets left out. Do you like the fact that they limit you as a voter, or do you wish this was allowed to be, hey, if you deserve it, you deserve it, no matter how many guys are on the list?
Yeah, I'm not going to be hypocritical about it, Bob. I can't say that I dislike it because I only used 9 of 10 spots this year.
Okay.
There have been a couple of times where I've thought, you know, I could use more. But this time I ran into a lot of the Hall of the Very Goods as opposed to the Hall of Fames when I did my tiebreakers and whatnot. So I only was, you know, coming up with nine. Doesn't mean there weren't a lot of other guys who deserved to be mentioned or considered. But I've never really gotten wrapped up in the 10 threshold. It's not that big of a deal to me. I suppose if you do come across a ballot someday that has 11 lock stock guaranteed Hall of Famers, then you sit there and you go, why can't it be at least 11 or 12, for example? But right now, I don't think 10 is a bad thing.
Yeah, I was listening to Tim Kirchin earlier, and he was talking about Jeff Kent, I think it was, who did not make his ballot, and it killed him because he said absolutely he belongs in the Hall of Fame, but he was limited because of, you know, the 10-person rule, and he made perfectly strong cases for the others, et cetera, and I'm sure that comes back and bites a lot of people, you know, as they get closer and closer to 75%, but just they were limited by that rule that allows each voter only 10 selections each and every year. Dennis, when can we hear or where can we hear your announcement after 6 o'clock as to your picks and why your defense?
I'll just have a video on Cleveland.com video, okay. Just Cleveland.com/Indians, and it'll be up there, and I'll just be talking about my ballot, and you know, it'll be sometime after 6, obviously, when the public announcement's made.
Well, I will look forward to checking that out. Dennis, thanks for talking about it with us this afternoon. We appreciate it, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Bob.
Dennis Maniloff, Cleveland.com sports writer and Cleveland Plain Dealer out there to the east of us doing some pretty good analysis there on the Hall of Fame vote that is going to be announced at 6 o'clock. We'll talk more about it right after this on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
He'll find Avogadro for a three, high on the right, good. And Toledo out to a 5-0 lead. Gave it up out top, back to Avogadro, and he knocks down another three. Now on the right wing, handed to Williams, drives baseline around Lillard, got to the basket and scored. Here's Alciguer with a three in the left corner. Boy, doesn't West need a pick-me-up. Lillard flies by, Avogadro shoots the three and hits it. Timeout, Bowling Green. Falcons had stretches tonight where they played very well, but longer stretches where they did not. Final score, Toledo 85, Bowling Green 73.
A new record. Clemens has set a major league record for strikeouts in a game. 20.
He's off and running. Here's the throw by Winter, and he is. Fastest of baseball lanes, Ty Cobb, Lou Brock, and Ricky Henderson, and now Tim Raines, his 800th stolen base.
High drive to left field, Bagwell watches it go, and this is number two of the game for him. Further out toward left center, over the 379 side, for number 20 and number 400 in his career.
And Barnes hits one high, hits it deep!
The story with Schilling, the ruptured sheath around the peroneal tendon in his right ankle. Marcane itself, if they're shooting into that ankle, or blood from the shots. It's like a scene from The Natural. A feeble swing by Sierra. He strikes out for the third time, and game six goes to the eighth.
Two-third, backhanded by the shortstop. Long got a hurry. Got him! Yes! 479! Trevor Hoffman has become the all-time saves leader in Major League Baseball history.
There it goes, deep left field, way back, and gone. Manny Ramirez, a three-run home run, and he has the record.
Manny Ramirez, a new Cleveland Indian RBI record with 164.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And we roll onward on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Want your thoughts this hour, or at least the rest of this half hour, as we take you up until about 4:35 or so. We're going to switch gears and get into college basketball as the UT-BG rivalry was renewed once again. You just heard some of the montage there, the highlights of UT's win, 12 points over BG. Their sixth straight. Cush, what's going on in the Battle of I-75? The Rocket basketball team has beaten the Falcons the last six times, and I believe it's six in a row, or is it seven for the Rockets football team?
I think it's six, both sixes in this case, and I'm not sure, except to say right now the battle of I-75 is coming up all Rockets right now.
No question about it. And sometimes it goes like that. Sometimes there are cycles, yeah. You know, and it just there's a run, and then it'll switch around, and the pendulum will swing. And at any rate, the head coach of the Falcons is Michael Huger, and he's going to talk to us coming up at about 4:35 about the BG season thus far, and of course that loss to the Rockets. But the other rest of that, as you just heard, some highlights, career highlights from the likes of Roger Clemens, Tim Raines, Jeff Bagwell, Barry Bonds, Curt Schilling, Vladimir Guerrero, and Manny Ramirez. Now some of
don't
those names.
Don't forget Trevor Hoffman.
Did I say Trevor Hoffman?
No.
Oh, I must skip right over. Oh, that's because it's not on my list. That's why I didn't.
Oh,
even...
did I not type my?
Yeah,
bad.
No, it's not there. It's okay because I did hear it. I heard him because you mentioned Hoffman becomes the all-time saves leader.
Right.
Which he did, of course, until it was he was passed by Mariano.
Exactly.
So yeah, and what's interesting is there are two guys on the list, Trevor Hoffman and Lee Smith, who were at one point the all-time saves leaders. By the way, you know who's fourth on that list? Do you not?
Fourth on the list?
Yeah.
I'm not sure who's fourth on the list.
You should
right now.
Know him. You should know him relatively well, to be honest with you. If that's not a hint for you, I mean, I'm trying to make that a hint for you to take a stab at this.
It's not
you
K-Rod, know him relatively it's not well. K-Rod, is it?
It is indeed. It is indeed. Francisco Rodriguez.
You know what? You're right. Yeah, he has been around quite a while.
430 saves. Now, he's still a far cry from 652 put up by Mariano Rivera,
right.
But still pretty... You know, he's within 48 of Lee Smith. He could easily get to third probably by the time he's done.
That's true.
So, at any rate, now I want to go back to one particular issue that I talked about with Dennis Maniloff, who is one of the Baseball Writers of Association Hall of Fame voters. I want to talk about Curt Schilling. And the story I told is, you know, it's not news. This is well understood and accepted by a lot of people. Curt Schilling is very, very outspoken in his retirement, and his propensity for social media to make what some would consider, and that's what makes this so difficult to discuss, what some might consider controversial statements, has gotten him into some trouble. It got him fired from ESPN as an analyst, a baseball analyst, because they didn't like some of his politics. And I find that very interesting, and I find that very, very troubling. As a fellow conservative-minded individual, which Curt Schilling is, you know, we see a lot of ball players stepping up and making very strong, politically left-of-center stances on matters of politics relating to what's going on in the world today, what's going on in the United States, around the country. A lot of the sports figures went out and campaigned openly for Hillary Clinton in the last election and so on and so forth, and nobody had a problem with that. Curt Schilling is an outspoken conservative, and who has backed conservative-minded individuals, including Donald Trump in the last election, and Curt Schilling has become essentially public enemy number one for a lot of sports-minded individuals with an eye toward politics as well. It's how dare he? How dare he make such a statement? How dare he take a stand against militant Islam and terrorism and so on and so forth in some of his messages? And according to many, it's costing him Hall of Fame votes. And I have to believe it's true. And here's the reason why. Because if you simply evaluate Curt Schilling, the baseball player, there is no possible way he gets 50% of the vote in the Baseball Hall of Fame voting. There's no way he gets less than the 75% necessary. And in fact, he ought to be up around 90% when you just look at baseball. And here's an example. Where does this come from, you may ask? I'm about to quote to you from MLB.com. This is straight from baseball itself. It's not some, you know, conservative website's opinion on this, that, or the other thing. This is from baseball. All right? Even though seven players have been inducted, I'm quoting now, into the National Baseball Hall of Fame over the past 2 years, many strong candidates remain on the ballot. With the Baseball Writers Association of America voters limited to a maximum of 10 players apiece and 75% of the vote required for enshrinement, several worthy candidates must travel the difficult road. Results of this year's BBWA vote revealed tonight, will be revealed tonight, I should say. Oh, hold on a second. Hold on a second. You know, I just realized. My apologies to you. This was actually written last year before the baseball vote was announced. It's about Curt Schilling, which is where I'm going with this, but it applies just as much this year because he's staying at about the same percent. So my apologies. It said January 6th, and that's obviously not correct because it's going to be tonight, January 18th. So that's why I realized this was actually a year old. This article from MLB.com is a year old. Doesn't matter. It's just as valid because Kurt hasn't pitched since last year either, has he? It's unlikely Kurt Schilling will be a part of that group, writes MLB. The right-hander who received 39.2% of the vote the last time around has a long ways to go. Now I can update that to say 50% the last time around, meaning last voting year. Schilling no doubt has suffered from his relatively low total of wins, 216, and a lack of a Cy Young Award, and perhaps getting overshadowed by his brilliant contemporaries and in some cases teammates such as Randy Johnson, as well as Greg Maddux and Pedro Martinez. But when it comes to the most relevant numbers, there is an impossibly strong case for the six-time All-Star and three-time Cy Young runner-up as a clear Hall of Famer. Here is a look at that argument. And I want to illustrate again. This is from MLB.com. Schilling's career value stacks up quite favorably. His 80.7 pitching wins above replacement, that's WAR, ranks 26th all-time. Yes, there are more than 25 pitchers in the Hall of Fame. So clearly, that puts him right there, according to BaseballReference.com, including 14th in the expansion era since 1961, 14th best WAR since 1961. He comes in that category, just behind Bob Gibson and well ahead of numerous Hall of Famers, including Don Sutton, Jim Palmer, Rapid Robert, Bob Feller, Juan Marichal, and Don Drysdale. But there's more. Baseball References wins above average, and Jim, I don't know how much of a metrics, sabermetrics guy you are, or analytics guy, but these stats, you know what WAR means, wins above replacement.
Yep.
The wins above average compares a player's performance to the league average,
right,
instead of to the hypothetical replacement player, as in WAR. By the standard of wins above league average, Schilling's 54-point run, one, is 10th since 1901. Ahead of names such as Gibson and Steve Carlton and Warren Spahn. Here's more. In 1968, baseball witnessed the year of the pitcher and responded by doing what? They lowered the mound.
Right.
Over the 47 years since then, here's where Kurt Schilling's career numbers fall in several important categories to Hall of Fame voters. A minimum of 2,500 innings pitched was used for the rate stats here. The strikeout-to-walk ratio, the best in the world. First, with a 4.3 out strikeout-to-walk ratio since the mound was lowered. Think about that for a moment. Think about all of the dominant pitchers, including Clemens, who's on this ballot. The strikeout-to-walk ratio, Kurt Schilling owns it. First, strikeouts per nine innings since the mound was lowered, fourth with 8.6. WHIP, which is walks and hits per innings pitched, fourth with 1.137. Walks per nine innings, sixth. Wins above average, as I mentioned, sixth since the mound was lowered. ERA plus, seventh. Strikeouts, ninth since the mound was lowered with 3,116. WAR, 10th with 80.7. And fielding independent pitching, 11th. That's 3.23. Those statistics are all taken into account by various Hall of Fame voters. By that standard alone, since the mound was lowered, he's one of the most dominant pitchers in the history of the game. And he's getting 50% of the vote? Here's more from MajorLeagueBaseball.com. Over his final 12 years, that's 1996 through 2007, and Jim, what could we call that period of time between 96 and 2007? Roughly speaking, what would we call that era in baseball?
The steroid era.
The steroid era, when offenses were off the charts because of all of the juice by various players. During the steroid era in 12 years, he was 173-104. That's a 6.25 winning percentage with an ERA of 3.43, averaging 200 innings and 200 strikeouts per season for 12 years. From 2001 to 2004, at his very peak, at the advanced ages of 34 to 37, by the way, and this is a guy who didn't cheat like Roger Clemens did to advance his career in his late 30s, Kurt Schilling from 2001 to 2004 led all pitchers in WAR with an average of 7.8. That includes Pedro Martinez, it includes Clemens, it includes Randy Johnson, etc., etc. He was also first in that time in strikeout-to-walk ratio, second in strikeouts overall, third in innings pitched, and FIP, and fourth in ERA+. And for good measure, in that period of time, Jim, between 2001 and 2004, Curt Schilling won 7 postseason games and 2 World Series rings. When it comes to one of the most important and sexy measures of pitchers, strikeouts and walks, a crucial part of the job, few in baseball history have been better. Curt Schilling is one of only 4 pitchers to record at least 300 strikeout seasons. The others, Randy Johnson, Nolan Ryan, Sandy Koufax, Hall of Famers all. Since 1900, we're talking literally, you know, a century plus now, 116 seasons. Since 1900, no pitcher with even 1,000 career innings pitched can match Schilling's 4.38 strikeout to walk ratio, let alone with 2,500 plus being the benchmark. Only one other pitcher with 2,000 plus innings, Pedro Martinez, is above 3.78. Curt Schilling owns the strikeout to walk ratio statistic by a large margin, even over Pedro. At his very best from 2001 to 2006, Curt Schilling posted a 6.75 strikeout to walk ratio. How far was that in front of number 2? It was Randy Johnson with 4.70. Schilling was responsible for 5 of the top 11 single season marks during that span, and his 9.58 in 2002 was the second best in history up until 2010, and it still ranks 4th best in history. And one more for perspective on Curt Schilling and why he must be in the Hall of Fame. Let's examine Tom Glavine. Tom Glavine sailed into the Hall on his first ballot, first year on the ballot, with 91.9% of the vote, right? And deservedly so. Would we agree?
Yeah.
The two pitchers, Glavine and Schilling, operated during the same exact period, the steroid era. Glavine does hold huge advantages in numbers of starts and innings pitched, and victories because he cracked the esteemed 300 victory mark, but that is more of a commentary on the teams he played on in terms of getting wins than what he did to get the other guys out, because here is how they compare in the categories of getting other guys out. In pitching war, Curt Schilling, 80.7. Tom Glavine, 74.0. Total war, Glavine, 81.5. Schilling, 79.9. Almost a dead heat. One's got 91% of the vote in the Hall, the other's got 50. In wins above average, Schilling 54.1, Tom Glavine 39.1. ERA plus, Schilling 127, Glavine 118. FIP, Schilling 323, Glavine 395. And strikeouts and walks, Schilling 4.4, Glavine 1.7. And if you're still on the fence about why Curt Schilling is not in the Hall of Fame and why he deserves the vote to be there, the 3-time World Series champion is one of the best postseason performers in baseball history. In 19 career postseason starts, he is 11-2 with a 2.23 ERA, including 2.06 over 7 World Series outings. Schilling was the MVP of the 93 NLCS for the Phillies, then threw a shutout in that year's World Series against Toronto, and set a single postseason record for strikeouts, 56 in the postseason for the 2001 Diamondbacks. That year, by the way, he produced a 1.12 ERA in the postseason, and Arizona won 5 of his 6 playoff outings, which included 3 complete games and a shutout. The only reason Curt Schilling is not getting 90% of the vote, the way Tom Glavine and so many others have gotten just sailed right into the Hall, is because of his political beliefs expressed without apology on Twitter. And that, my friends, is a shame. Got to get out now, get a SportsCenter, because on the other side, we're going to shift gears. I'm sorry, Jim? Oh, yeah, of course. We've got to do our high school athletes of the week. My apologies. I meant to do that on the way into the last segment and completely got sidetracked because, well, I have ADHD. Our KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week. We want to give props where they are due to the girls. Caitlin Deringer of Northview Diving. She won her fourth consecutive NLL Diving Championship on Friday with 420.2 points, beating out a fellow Northview diver for the title by 33 points. Thank you to Brenda and Joe Deringer for their nomination. And for the boys, Derek Rayford of Whitmer Basketball scored 15 of his 24 in the fourth quarter as Whitmer came from behind to beat Lima Senior on Friday, 63-54. Whitmer now 7-4 overall and 4-2 in the track. They are your KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week. Outstanding job by them, and make sure that you nominate your favorite athlete if they're doing wonderful things on their relative sports and fields of play, or in the case of Caitlin, water. We want your nomination sent to us at athlete at 1065theticket.com. 1065theticket.com. So we will take your nominations, and now we're going to take that time out and get SportsCenter coming your way before we shift gears and get into college basketball with Coach Michael Huger of BG coming up next.
Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 1065 The Ticket.
And welcome back into the Extravaganza. Jim Kuslin hanging out with you now and talking some college basketball. We are at this point. And it was the Battle of I-75, part one of the basketball version yesterday, 85-73. The Rockets getting the win over the Bowling Green Falcons. That game was played at Savage. A couple weeks from now, it'll shift to the Stroh Center. And to help us talk all things Bowling Green basketball related, we once again welcome in the head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Michael Huger. Hi, Coach. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Not too bad. Not as good of a night, though, for your squad. Last night, 85-73, falling to the rival Toledo Rockets. They have won a couple of these, let's just call it that, in a row now in this overall series. And was this game yesterday, because I've talked with Coach Kowalczyk, as I talk with you, of course, too. And one thing I've noticed over the course of the season, they have a lot of very interesting offensive weapons. We saw that come out in this game yesterday. Was that a matter of most of what this was, that Toledo was just hitting things offensively? They shot 54% from the field. Was this just one of those days where they were just shooting very well?
Oh, they shot it very well. You know, they had guys that stepped up. Navigado had 22 points, and I think he led them, and I think he's averaging about 8 a game. So they had a different guy step up yesterday and play well for them, and that was the difference in the game. They also shot the ball extremely well yesterday. So, you know, next time around, we got to change up some things, and hopefully they don't hit those same shots.
They went up by 11 at the intermission, 43-32, so they got off to a good early start. Was this a matter of also, combined with what we just said, was this also a matter of they put themselves in a position where they had essentially a double-digit lead early in this game, and you guys just couldn't make up the ground?
Yeah, turnovers cost us in that second half. We made in the end of the first half, you know, we were down, I think, 20-6 to start and put in some subs, and they were able to bring us back, and we had the lead, I think, at 32-30. And then they went on a big run, you know, at the end of the half where we turned the ball over and couldn't score at that moment and get any stops, and that was the difference in that half. And, you know, they had an 11-point lead going into halftime, but was able to fight back in the second half as well. Didn't get off to the best start to start the second half, but, you know, we were able to hang in there, hang tough. But once we made that run, we had some critical turnovers at the end, and Navigado hit a big three at the end that kind of, you know, sealed the deal for those guys.
And, you know, you're talking about especially that first half, Coach. It was a game of runs. They went up 20-6, as you mentioned. But then you guys, especially when you guys both went to your benches, made a nice run yourself to come back. There's got to be some encouraging things, at least from that aspect, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely encouraging. I'm happier with my defense and the way we played, even though they shot 54%. We gave energy and effort, and Toledo was just better last night. But, you know, in the previous two games, we didn't have that energy and effort on the defensive end. So that part changed for us last night. So pleased with that, but we still made some critical mistakes that cost us the game.
You did have a couple guys have some decent games. Wiggins with a double-double, 17-11. Zach Denny added 12 points, 7 rebounds. Then he had West with 14 points and 7 rebounds on himself as well. So you did get some production. And Ali, they all single digits, 9, 8, and 5, but that's a pretty good line, especially with the 8 assists. So talk to me about some of the performances of some of your guys, even in defeat.
Oh, I like the performance. Still thought we could have done more. You know, DiMaggio with 17. I think he only missed two shots, so that was good. But rebounded well. I thought he could have done more on the boards. I thought all of our guys could have done more in the rebounding department, even though we out-rebounded Toledo. But, you know, we can do more. And that was the thing I wanted to stress to our guys. You know, we can't be satisfied with this performance. You know, we have to be able to do more. We have to be able to get stops when we need stops. We have to be able to rebound when we need rebounds. And I thought that was the thing we missed yesterday. And that was the difference in the game.
We're talking with Bowling Green Falcons head coach Michael Huger here on the Extravaganza. Jim Kuslin with you right now. And you mentioned something a second ago that caught my eye. And on top of this, there was also Saturday's game against Northern Illinois. So 1-4 start to Mid-American Conference play is, I got to believe, something that you were hoping not to have happen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, it's always one game at a time. And, you know, that's what I live by. But, you know, with 1-4 is always disappointing with that record. But, you know, it's still a long season and a long way to go. So we got to keep fighting, keep plugging away, and, you know, taking it one step at a time and get better and improving our defense. And if we improve our defense, that improves our offense. So we're better in transition and getting stops and getting out on the fast break. So, you know, it's still a work in progress. It's still building. We're still building. We're not here yet, but we're headed in the right direction.
We're talking with head coach Michael Huger of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza. Jim Kuslin here with you. And, you know, coach, one thing, whether it's you or Coach Kowalczyk of the Rockets or in past years, I always get the same kind of thing, and I feel it's playing out again this year. They may not, this conference, the Mid-American Conference, may not get the national recognition, but this is, as we all know, a tough conference, top to bottom. So we played five games, but you haven't seen everybody, obviously, yet over the course of schedule. That'll play itself out. But your impressions overall of the strength of the Mid-American Conference this season?
Oh, tough league. I mean, very tough. Nationally, I think we're ranked 10th or 11th in the country. So, you know, I mean, that tells you how tough a league we're in. Teams are competing every day. Anybody can beat anybody in our league. So that's the beauty of the league. But the top of the league is very tough. The middle, the bottom, everywhere you go is tough. It's a tough place, you know, to beat, you know, and then games are hard to come by at home or on the road. So that's the difference in our league. And it's a fun league. Fun league. We have very good coaches, and we got some talent in the league as well. So that makes it very competitive all the way around. So just looking forward to a bounce back in the next couple games, and you know, hopefully we can start winning a few.
Well, let's start with the first game on that possible bounce back slate. It's Saturday at Stroh Center. You guys get Ball State. That's the second time you've seen them already this year, and that's the one win in conference play you guys have, 76-71, back on Saturday the 7th. So obviously we've already seen Ball State, and you guys did get a win against them in their building in Muncie. When you play a team for the second time, obviously there's going to be some possible adjustments, even if you won the game before.
Yes, you got to make adjustments. They'll make adjustments. We'll have to make adjustments. The hardest part about playing a team that you beat is when you got 18 to 21 year olds, they all think it's going to be probably that easy again, or we don't have to work as hard this time around, and now you got to work that much harder to get the second victory. And you know, that's the point we got to get across to our guys, that we can't relax. And now we're on a three-game losing streak, so we got to bounce back. And, you know, it's a good way to bounce back when you got a home game, you got your home crowd, and, you know, an opponent that you're familiar with. But we can't underestimate them in no way, no how, because since we beat them, they haven't lost. So that's the difference.
Yeah, very, very well said and very apropos in this case. It's Ball State coming to Stroh Center, coming up on Saturday, 2 o'clock, the pregame time. Of course, we'll have it for you over on Talk Radio 100.7. Coach, best of luck out there on Saturday. Rivalry week, as we know, didn't go so well. But, hey, you get another crack at them. That'll be at Stroh Center, by the way, folks, on Saturday, February 4th. Do you like the fact, by the way, that because this is recent in this sense? I remember a couple years ago, and you know, you're now head coach of Bowling Green. You played for Bowling Green back in the day. How nice is it to be able to play the Rockets twice a year, once in each building? Because there was a couple year span where on the basketball court, you guys would only meet once a year, and I always thought that was silly.
Yeah, I'm happy that we get an opportunity to play him twice in one season. You know, it was rough last year only playing him once, even though it was at home. But you always want another crack at your rival. And, you know, now that we got them coming to the straw, I'm excited to get a second chance at them this year. Last year it was like, oh, we got to wait till next year. And hopefully, you know, we'll see where we played them at and all of that stuff. Now, you know, we get an opportunity in the same season. So I love that. It's great for the fans. It's great for the coaches. You know, it's great for recruiting. So it's just fun all the way around.
Yeah, and that, by the way, folks, is the fourth game of five. The next five, you get four of them at Stroh Center, and that's kind of nice as well. You mentioned looking for some bounce back at home, and again, it starts Saturday, this Saturday, against Ball State at Stroh Center. Coach, best of luck to you out there on that one. Hopefully when we reconvene next week, we're talking about a couple of Falcon wins.
Yes, thank you.
That is head coach Michael Huger of the Bowling Green Falcons taking some time talking with us here on the Extravaganza on the Ticket. Yeah, for what it's worth, Bowling Green, they at least have some home cooking coming up. You got Ball State on Saturday. The next Tuesday, it's at Central Michigan. That is followed by a three-game homestand that will carry us into February the 28th. That's a Saturday against Ohio, then Tuesday the 31st against Miami, and then Saturday the 4th, the rematch against the Toledo Rockets at Stroh Center. So four of the next five for the Falcons coming up at Stroh Center, and they definitely need that in a way, because, you know, obviously Bowling Green is a program that has some work still to do. I'm still liking some of the progression we're seeing out of year two right now with head coach Michael Huger, but the fact of the matter is his team is now 1-4. Miami and Kent State also 1-4. That's the bottom of the East Division. Bowling Green is 7-11, so that's one of only three teams, the other two being Miami and Western, that are below 500 overall. We knew it was going to be an overall struggle to get this program back to playing pretty decent and over 500 basketball, but you're starting to see some of the progressions. And yeah, for last night in the rivalry Battle of I-75 game, and we'll be talking with head coach, by the way, of the Rockets, Todd Kowalczyk, on tomorrow's show. And, you know, you've heard us talk to him so far. They've had their issues too, but one issue they don't have is offensive capabilities. The Toledo Rockets are a very, very solid team, especially on the offensive side of the ball. They average 82.8 points a game. They give up 78.6, but they average 82.8, and that's high on the slate when it comes to college basketball. As you know, how many games have we seen in the 50s over the course of time, and even this year? So you know the Rockets are a decent offensive team, and as Coach mentioned, that first half was a battle of runs. And if there's one thing that's encouraging, that I gotta believe that's gonna be some of the film they use, even though that was bench versus bench, was after going down 20-6, they go on their own run and take a brief lead before the Rockets catapult themselves back to a double-digit lead with a run of their own to end that first half. And, you know, as Coach said, if you can cut down the turnovers, and we hear this all the time from not just Coach Huger but Coach Kowalczyk and others, if you cut down those turnovers, better things are going to happen. And, of course, the Falcons had some turnover issues in that game yesterday, particularly in the first half. They ended up turning the ball over 14 times total, but a good chunk of those were in bad spots in that first half. And when you play a team that's as offensively capable as the Toledo Rockets are, turning the ball over to them, giving them the extra possessions, is just not a good thing. But overall, as I look at the Mid-American Conference, because, you know, now everybody's basically five games in, and the MAC schedule is pretty standard. Tuesday, Saturday, with the occasional Friday game. Example, the Rockets played last Friday night, for example. But most of the games will be Tuesdays and Saturdays as we go through MAC play for the remainder of the year. And now, you know, it's later in January. We're past MLK Day. We're a couple weeks into conference play. So every team's played, as of yesterday, basically now five games. So you're starting to get a little inside info as to how this conference is shaping up. You know, everybody, when conference play starts, they always want to look at overall records. Oh, this team's good, this team's not. But in a conference like the Mid-American Conference, it doesn't really matter until you start playing everybody. And to that end, what we're looking at right now is an Akron team that looks incredibly solid. They are 5-0 right now, leading the East, 15-3 overall. Their three losses were at Youngstown State. Okay, that's kind of a bad loss. That was on opening night way back in November. But then also in out-of-conference play, obviously all their losses are out-of-conference, Can't really blame them for these two losses. They lost at Creighton when they were 10th ranked, and then they lost at Gonzaga when they were 8th ranked. Gonzaga, by the way, is the only undefeated team left in Division One, and they're number 5, and Creighton's in the top 10 still. So two of your three losses to top 10 powers type schools. I know Gonzaga's in the West Coast Conference, and that's still kind of a small mid-major, but Gonzaga themselves is more or less always feels like a power type of team, and Creighton now part of the Big East. So you have those kind of losses, which are kind of understandable, but then having taken care of business in Mid-American Conference play so far, beating all comers, BG, Western, Central, Miami, and Ohio. And Ohio's an interesting one because the way the East is shaping up, Kent State is, as I mentioned, off to a bad start. They're 1-4 league play, 9-9 overall. So unless they could start turning it on, the East division feels like it's Akron with maybe an outside chance of Ohio making some noise. And Akron already has a 1-0 season series lead on the Bobcats. In the West, and I've been trying to argue and think that the West is getting better, and I still think it is getting better, but each team has various intricacies in their schedules and their rosters that have put them where they're at. Example, you know, we just talked about the Rockets' offensive capabilities, but they still at times turn the ball over too much, as Coach Kowalczyk has said in past interviews when we've had him on. As a result, Toledo, despite their offensive capabilities, 3-2 overall, 10-8 in the league. The West Division is right now led by a couple of teams, at least a year or two ago, you may not have expected. Eastern and Northern, both 4-1 and 12-6 in league play. Ball State, despite being the one team in league play that Bowling Green has beaten so far, they're 12-6 overall and 3-2 in conference play. And Eastern and Northern are very interesting because, A, on the one hand, Northern Illinois, basketball-wise, has usually been at the bottom of the standings, especially when their football team a couple years ago was really, really good. You'd always get to basketball season and be like, oh, basketball, totally opposite of football for Northern Illinois. So they're an improving program. And then Eastern Michigan with that zone type of thing that they do that's somewhat unique. It's not, well, all right, unique may not be the correct word there, but certainly a zone system that not a lot of people use, and it gives a lot of teams fits, as we saw. So, and they've been running that for a couple years, and now they even have better personnel going. So 4-1, 12-6 out of Eastern doesn't surprise me. And by the by, can I just say, kudos overall to Eastern Michigan. Usually on both the football field and the basketball court, usually, let's call it what it is, one of the dregs of this conference. But they made, football-wise, they went 7-5 and made their second ever bowl game, and first since like 1991 or whatever it was. They weren't even called the Eagles back then. They were still known as the Hurons, the only other time they made a bowl game. And now the basketball team, which has usually been at the bottom of the West standings, they sit at the top. So a little tip of the cap to the overall Eastern Michigan program, getting both football and basketball at least turned in the right direction and actually winning games here and there and or being over 500. But keep an eye on Eastern Michigan. That zone, again, gives people fit. And it absolutely does. And that's going to do it for this edition of the Extravaganza. Stick around. Mike Miller's coming up next. Doubleheader, Drive Time, and Face Off, the hockey show. It's all straight ahead here on The Ticket. What a...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep their trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.